3.4 million servicemen with 500,000 in the Marines, and air, 2.4 million investments. By the beginning of the war with Germany in 1941, the Soviets had no carriers and only three aged battleships. By 1944, the Red Fleet's allotment had been reduced from pre-war levels even further to only about 6% of the Soviet defense budget. The Soviet Union, for all its talk of worldwide communist expansion in the 1920s, did not prepare for it militarily, focusing instead on the defense of the motherland. Privately, Soviets assumed that they would have to deal with the armies of Japan to the east and Germany to the west, or another possible intervention from Western powers, while conducting offensive ground operations against their own immediate land neighbors, such as Poland and Finland. Given such strategic objectives and its self-sufficiency in oil, food, and ores, it made less sense to invest in a navy comparable to its enemies or allies, especially after postponing earlier ideas of promoting worldwide communist expansion by force. While Russia entered the war with the largest numbers of submarines, for instance, it had the smallest surface fleet of the six major combatants. Given poor weather in the Baltic and Northern Seas, and given that Germany did not often bring what was left of its fleet into Russian waters, there was to be no major battle between the German and Russian Northern fleets. The other two Soviet naval forces, in the Black Sea and the Pacific, played small roles in the Allied victories. The Japanese remained loyal to the terms of their non-aggression pact with the Soviets to such a degree that almost half of U.S. lend-lease material was shipped safely from West Coast ports on Soviet vessels directly to Russia at the port of Vladivostok. This alternate so-called Pacific lend-lease route of Russian merchant vessels became one of the safest transit paths of the entire war. Russian submarines by 1944 were sometimes sinking Axis freighters and small surface ships in the Black Sea and Eastern Baltic, but no Russian or German warship altered the course of Operation Barbarossa. When Russia finally piled on Japan days before the ending of the Pacific War, it had to borrow over 250 small ships from the United States just to occupy Sakhalin Island and a few Japanese islands in the Kuril Archipelago. Before the USSR was invaded in June 1941, Stalin looked fondly on the idea of German U-boats tying down Britain and slowly starving it into submission. After Operation Barbarossa, Stalin flipped, hopeful that the British Navy would nullify the German fleet, interrupt scheduled supply convoys for Germany's Army Group North, and supply the Soviet Union with war material. After December 7, 1941, Stalin further assumed that the British and American fleets would consume Japanese naval attention, thus precluding both a second Axis ground front against the Soviet Union and the need for Russia to conduct a two-theater offensive war. There would be plenty of time after the war, when Soviet ambitions turned global, to invest in a blue water fleet to promote Russian imperial expansionism. As early as 1939, strategists had warned their publics that the looming war would be fought on all fronts far differently than was World War I. Such apprehensions largely arose because of new medium strategic bombers and the use of reliable, fast tanks that might turn static warfare into a conflict of mobility and encirclement. Whereas observers expected U-boats once again to seek to strangle Great Britain and isolate it from its overseas suppliers while breaking the blockade of Germany, almost no naval expert foresaw the predominant role that aircraft carriers were almost immediately to play. America's war began with a devastating attack of enemy carriers on Battleship Row at Pearl Harbor. Yet almost all senior American naval officers sighed relief that the three Pacific Theater carriers, Enterprise, Lexington, and Saratoga, were out to sea at the time of the attack. Rarely in military history had an iconic asset, the battleship, metamorphosed so rapidly from an irreplaceable emblem of national maritime strength into an ossified anachronism. There may not have been a pre-war carrier role at Pearl Harbor, but if there had been, and if it were severely damaged, there would not have been a sigh of relief that at least the Japanese had missed three battleships out to sea. pre-war carriers mostly were fashioned from converted ocean liners, battle cruisers, or battleship hulls. Sometimes an ironic reaction to the 1922 Washington Naval Treaty's restrictions on battleship tonnages, with no consensus on optimum designs, armament, speed, or size. While post-treaty ships like the Akagi, Kaga, Lexington, and Saratoga were undeniably large, their designs were not emulated by later models that were conceived from the hull up as carriers. Early naval biplanes were neither fast nor reliable enough to place their ordnance consistently on targets in a way that would ensure that enemy surface ships, in the age before radar, could not sneak up and blast vulnerable carriers out of the water. As a result, many early carriers were armed with 8- and 5-inch gun batteries. Perhaps it was more tolerable for the battleship interests to envision pre-war carriers as veritable battle cruisers with an array of turret batteries in addition to a flight deck. The maximum ranges of most battleships' main batteries, 14, 15, 16, or even 18-inch guns, varied from 16 to 25 miles, depending on the size of the charge, type of projectile, elevation of the gun, and velocity of the shot. The shell's destructive power was not just determined by the caliber of the gun, but depended on additional factors such as velocity and the payload, which in turn were also predicated on the quality and length of the barrels. The 16-inch guns of an Iowa-class battleship, for example, were probably as destructive as the Yamato's 18-inch batteries due to the former's heavier and faster-moving, but smaller diameter, projectiles. Most World War II guns could fire salvos every 35 or 40 seconds and keep that rate of fire up either until their ammunition was depleted or the barrels began to wear out, somewhere between 150 to 400 shots, depending on the nature of the shell, the size of its propellant, and the quality of the ship's barrels. Battleships were the masters of the seas in their tiny radiuses of about 20 miles. A standard fleet carrier, in contrast, might easily send off three or four sorties of 30 or 40 bombers and fighters per day against an enemy 200 miles away, over an hour's flight depending on weather conditions, with a high likelihood that some of its dive and torpedo bombers would place ordnance on the target, while the vigilant mother carrier stayed out of range of an enemy's big guns. The problem with battleships was not that they could not do more destructive damage to ships and shoreline installations than carriers, and at a cheaper cost and in less time than a carrier's planes, but that they lacked naval aviation's range and were far more vulnerable to counterattack. A torpedo hit from a carrier plane was usually more likely to damage a battleship than was a barrage from another surface ship. Carriers, then, could also offer a greater array of techniques for damaging a ship, from strafing to dive bombing to aerial torpedo attacks. Naval fighter screens offered far better defenses against air attack than those of a battleship's anti-aircraft batteries, and with good radar, naval aircraft could spot potential attacks and prepare for them with sophisticated air patrols. Aircraft carriers were also cheaper to build, a flight deck costing less capital and labor than a battleship's massive and intricately machined gun turrets. The new Iowa-class battleships that entered the Pacific in 1943 and 1944 each cost about $20 million more than the late-model Essex-class fleet carriers and required almost as many crewmen, nearly 3,000, as carriers. Their 9 16-inch guns could theoretically fire over 1,000 huge shells an hour, each weighing nearly 3,000 pounds, at targets well over 20 miles distant. But they had no ability to hit anything 2 to 300 miles away, as could the 90 to 100 planes on a new Essex-class carrier. Anything a battleship could do, blow up surface ships, bombard shore positions, show the flag, a carrier could usually do better and almost as cheaply. In the 6 years of World War II, only on three occasions did a battleship sink or even help to sink a carrier. During the Norway campaign, the obsolete and relatively small HMS Glorious, converted to a carrier in the late 1920s, was surprised on June 8, 1940, and sunk by the German battleships Scharnhorst and Gneisenau due to the utter incompetence of the captain who had failed to provide customary air patrols. Likewise, the small escort carrier Gambier Bay was destroyed on October 25, 1944, by the Japanese heavy cruiser Chikuma and the battleship Yamato. The Japanese converted light carrier Chiyoda was finished off in the Battle of Cape Engano, October 25, 1944, by American cruisers after suffering damage from aerial attack. In contrast, carrier aircraft during the war sank well over a dozen battleships, as well as hundreds of cruisers, destroyers, and submarines. The Axis's four largest and most expensive battleships, Bismarck, Musashi, Tirpitz, and Yamato, were all sunk or severely damaged by naval aircraft. Battleships proved an evolutionary dead end in World War II, and after a century of preeminence gradually disappeared from most of the world's fleets in the post-war era. The firepower of the grand ships of battleship row that were put out of commission at Pearl Harbor, most of them first deployed during and right after World War I, was not all that different from that of their modern successors of 1943. Until the age of guided missiles, it was difficult for a conventional World War II surface ship, given problems of accuracy, to consistently hit another ship at ranges much over 15 miles. Yet the mystique of battleships still prevailed for a while. A two-centuries-old romantic image of British and French men-of-war lining up to blast each apart at close ranges during the Napoleonic Wars. Battleships were beautiful, sacred vessels. Their size and guns were a testament to national power. Rare though battleship duels were, there was something about such raw, unambiguous displays of lethal force that captivated admirals and tended to cloud their judgment about the cost-to-benefit values of such majestic dinosaurs. What preserved the idea of a post-war surface cruiser was the introduction of guided missiles in the 1960s. For the first time, they gave larger surface ships the ability to hit targets at ranges of hundreds of miles, comparable to carriers' air fleets. And while we assume that cruisers and battleships are now long obsolete notions, today's new American Zumwalt-class destroyers in reality are pocket battleships of a sort, displacing some 14,500 tons, larger than most World War II heavy cruisers. In contrast to World War II surface ships' more or less fixed armaments, naval aircraft were upgraded constantly and often radically so. By 1943, American Hellcats, Helldivers, and Avengers were qualitatively different planes from their earlier counterparts. Both battleships and carriers often shared the same basic hull substructures, yet the latter updated its offensive reach in a way impossible for the former's guns. The limits of a battleship's gun range, whether it was of the North Dakota or the newer Iowa class, were static. In contrast, in 1942, a standard carrier torpedo plane's theoretical total range was about 450 miles. For example, the Douglas TBD Devastator, with a combat radius of about half that distance. Yet just a year later, most carriers could deploy torpedo bombers with a range of 1,000 miles when equipped with auxiliary tanks and an active combat radius of almost 400 miles, for example, the Grumman TBF Avenger. In other words, carriers could double their targeting range without substantially modifying their hulls, engines, or decks. Had Germany and Italy finished a carrier for each of their battleships and battle cruisers, for example, a Graf Zeppelin-class carrier carrying 12 or so modified Bf-109s and perhaps 30 adapted Ju-87 Stukas, they would have had a far better chance of winning the battles for the Atlantic and Mediterranean. The second great revolution in naval warfare was under the sea. Even early model submarines, especially German U-boats, had proven deadly in World War I. They could be built and manned far more cheaply than cruisers and battleships, and yet had the potential to be far more lethal to merchant shipping, especially until the Allies developed effective mines, depth charges, convoys, and air patrols. Quick dives by U-boats usually were better defenses against air attack than were a surface ship's anti-aircraft batteries. A U-boat fleet for a rearming Germany offered a fast-track method of attacking British shipping without the expense of seeking parity with the Royal Navy's huge surface fleet. For most of World War I, before and after the Battle of Jutland, the Germans had parked their surface fleet, but their submarine fleet had attacked the Allies all over the globe and sunk over 5,000 ships. By 1939, the promise of improved submarines seemed to guarantee greater success in World War II, given superior ranges, speeds, depths, and armament. German submarines accounted for far more sunken enemy merchant shipping and warships, well over 14 million tons worth, than all the battleships, cruisers, air power, and mines of the Third Reich combined, 7 million tons. The cost-to-benefit ratios of submarines versus large surface ships explained why subs proliferated and battleships became calcified, and why the Germans soon regretted diverting precious resources from submarine construction to their surface fleet. When the Bismarck went down in May 1941, so too did an investment of some 200 million Reichmarks and 2,200 sailors. Its sister ship, the slightly larger Tirpitz, may have been even more expensive. 1,000 German seamen were lost when British bombers finally blew up the battleship in a Norwegian fjord in November 1944. The combined but paltry efforts of the two huge battleships resulted in one destroyed British battlecruiser, the iconic HMS Hood, some damage to a British battleship and a few cruisers, and on one occasion the shelling of British installations on the island of Spitsbergen. The Tirpitz never fired its main battery at any seagoing vessel, nearly similar to the experience of the wasted assets of the even bigger Japanese white elephant, Musashi. Yet submarines sank some 17 aircraft carriers in World War II, far more than the two carriers lost to salvos from surface ships. Years after the war, Admirals Dönitz and Raeder, while together as inmates of Spandau Prison, still argued over naval allotments, with Dönitz blaming his one-time superior for shorting the U-boat fleet to build glamorous but otherwise relatively bloated surface ships. In defeat in the Battle of the Atlantic, Germany's expense in U-boat construction and service was about a tenth of the costs that the Allies lost in sunken cargoes, ships, and investments in anti-submarine warfare. The Kriegsmarine suffered horrendous losses, 781 of over 1,100 U-boats built, entailing about 33,000 of some 40,000 deployed U-boat crewmen. Nonetheless, this was less than Allied lives lost on merchant ships and warships, approximately 72,000. All German losses from U-boats, men and equipment combined, proved a fraction of what was consumed in a number of major land battles. Yet German submariners came closer than any of the Wehrmacht's air or land forces to curtailing the war effort of Great Britain. German submarines could easily have been even more astutely deployed. The Kriegsmarine sank some 14.5 million tons of American, British, and Russian shipping, or 18,565 tons sunk for each U-boat lost. In contrast, the American submarine fleet in the Pacific lost just 52 boats while sinking 5.2 million tons, about 102,000 tons sunk for every submarine lost. While German submarines sank almost 9 million aggregate tons of shipping more than did the American submarine fleet, the U-boat force was also nearly four times larger and fought almost 2 years longer. The reason for the superior efficiency of the American submarine fleet lay in the Allied ability to conduct anti-submarine operations far more effectively than either the Japanese or Germans. But additionally, American submarines were larger, with superior radar, and were better suited for the conditions of the Pacific than were U-boats for the Atlantic. Most important, German U-boat operations were micromanaged by Admiral Karl Dönitz in a way untrue of his American counterpart in the Pacific, Admiral Charles Lockwood. Prior to World War II, the prevailing naval logic dictated that all surface ships should become more deadly as they become larger, given the greater number of 14 to 16-inch guns they mounted and the increases in their armor belts. More utilitarian submarines and destroyers were customarily an afterthought in pre-war assessments of naval power. The average early 20th century destroyer, of about 1,200 to 1,500 tons of displacement, 4 to 6 4-inch guns, and speeds over 30 knots with 10 to 12 torpedo tubes, originally came into modern use just prior to World War I to protect the fleet by screening more valuable ships from surface or submarine attack. Destroyers also served as scouts that could radio back information on enemy positions. They were especially valuable in patrolling enemy shorelines, sinking merchant craft, and deterring attacks from fast torpedo boats. During World War I, destroyers had come into their own as the anti-submarine ship of choice, which could be built in great numbers and whose depth charges and light guns could escort a convoy at far less cost than cruisers. Destroyers' 3-, 4-, or 5-inch guns were considered too small to do much damage to larger surface ships. Their torpedoes could sink battleships and cruisers, but they were usually too vulnerable to get within accurate torpedo range. In the interwar period, the size of individual destroyers grew. In part, they were not, as were cruisers, subject to the initial limitations of ship-class tonnage in various naval agreements, at least until the London Naval Limitation Treaty agreements of the latter 1930s. But for reasons of economy, it soon made more sense to expand upon a cheaper destroyer hull than to downsize a light cruiser. In terms of a cost-benefit analysis of comparative naval tonnage required for patrolling the seas, it would have made far greater sense, for example, for the German Kriegsmarine to disperse 20 versatile destroyers across the Atlantic than to send out the single battleship Bismarck. World War II revolutionized the use of the destroyer. Equipped with radar and sonar, better torpedoes and far more anti-aircraft guns and multiple depth charge throwers, destroyers were by war's end the most versatile vessels. By cramming such diverse weapons systems into such a small and inexpensive ship, the destroyer became essential in escorting convoys, hunting down and screening the fleet from submarines, and serving as radar pickets posted on the circumference of a fleet to ward off air attacks, both conventional and kamikaze. The small size of destroyers made them hard to hit targets, and because, as tin cans, destroyers had thin metal skins, often huge armor-piercing shells from cruisers and battleships went right through their infrastructures without exploding, as in the engagement off Samar, October 25, 1944, during the Battle of Leyte Gulf. In contrast, on rare occasions, destroyer torpedoes sank enemy cruisers and battleships, such as the Japanese battleship Fuso that was probably torpedoed by the American destroyer Melvin at the Battle of the Surigao Strait, October 24 and 25, 1944. As in the case of fighter aircraft and tanks, such as the French Dewatina fighter and the Char B-1 tank, a Navy's theoretical technological superiority did not necessarily equate to maritime efficacy. In the pre-war period, the French, who deployed some of the most impressive cruisers and battleships on the seas, had also redefined the ideal destroyer with the 6 ships of its path-breaking Le Fantasque class, displacing 2,600 tons, reaching incredible speeds of over 40 miles an hour, and equipped with 5 5.4-inch guns. Yet French command, organization, experience, and morale did not match French nautical engineering skill, and French industry never turned out late-model ships and planes in sufficient numbers. Like the rest of the French fleet, most of the Le Fantasque-class destroyers sought refuge in North African ports and became irrelevant after June 1940. In total, 490 destroyers were sunk during the war, more than all other classes of surface ships combined. The United States alone lost 68 destroyers, but not a single battleship after Pearl Harbor or a fleet carrier after October 1942. Building hundreds of destroyers instead of dozens of battleships or carriers spread risk, protected the greater investment of larger ships, and allowed an American naval presence in areas of marginal concern. The British, desperate for help in the Battle of the Atlantic in September 1940, had traded basing rights in the Caribbean and Newfoundland to the Americans in exchange for 50 old U.S. destroyers, not in hopes of receiving a battleship or two or a dozen cruisers. From the first to the last year of the war, it was the destroyer that proved the most economical investment in terms of cost to build and man versus the benefits that accrued. When the war was over, the contours of post-war fleets were established for the next 70 years, anchored by submarines, destroyers, and carriers. Battleships and World War II-type cruisers all but vanished from the seas. In the next 2 chapters, concerning sea battles in the Atlantic and Pacific, 6 years of naval warfare in World War II are defined by 3 constant themes. First, the Axis powers before the war did not build enough ships of the sort that might have saved them, especially superb German U-boats and Japanese fleet carriers. Instead, they invested in far too many expensive battleships and heavy cruisers that brought them little advantage. Second, the victorious British and American navies were authentic two-ocean fleets with the ability to send warships equally against the Japanese, Germans, or Italians and supply vessels around the globe. The Axis armadas, in contrast, rarely ventured beyond their respective seas. Third, Great Britain and the United States both started and ended the war with the world's largest navies for logical reasons. Sustained naval supremacy rested on the less romantic advantages of industrial capacity and policy, accumulated experience, and the ability to train quickly and competently thousands of naval officers and sailors. 8. From the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. The first most evenly matched and longest theater of naval battle in World War II was in the North Atlantic and, on occasion, the North and Baltic Seas. It was fought largely by U-boats and a few surface ships of the Kriegsmarine against British and North American convoys, escort warships, and long-range aircraft. The so-called Battle of the Atlantic began as a partial replay of the German U-boat effort in World War I. Once again, German naval strategists thought they might starve Britain into submission, a nation that now needed 55 million tons annually of imported food and natural resources to survive. Barring that, the planners of the U-boat war dreamed of disrupting the Allied blockade of German ports, or at least obtaining naval superiority near the shores of occupied Europe, thereby precluding any future Allied effort to stage amphibious landings. Despite revolutionary breakthroughs in German nautical communications and engineering during the interwar period, what had doomed the Imperial German U-boat effort of World War I would mostly do the same to the U-boat fleet of the Third Reich. Once more the Allies, again with a belated entry of the United States, would produce far more merchant ships than the U-boats could sink, and thus win the tonnage war. Once more, the Allies would develop new anti-submarine technologies and countermeasures faster and more efficiently than the Germans could improve submarines. Whereas the Imperial German U-boat fleet destroyed nearly 13 million tons of Allied shipping by November 1918, at the cost of 178 submarines and 5,000 crewmen lost in combat, the Third Reich, at war for 6, not 4 years, would do little better. 14 million tons, while losing over 5 times as many crews, approximately 33,000 submariners, and over 4 times as many U-boats, 781. The Battle of the Atlantic was fought over 6 years, from the first days of the war in 1939 to mid-1943, with residual sparring until the war's end in spring 1945. Along with the warships of its Commonwealth allies, Britain's fleet from mid-1940 to December 1941 was the only credible Allied navy still fighting the Kriegsmarine. The British Navy tried to blockade Germany and its territories in occupied Europe, as well as to starve out its armies. But such a time-tested strategy initially assumed that Germany would fight largely along its borders as it had in World War I, with its maritime access traditionally limited to the North and Baltic Seas, and without access to the Atlantic. Neither assumption proved true in World War II. Two factors are constant throughout naval history. First, the location and security of bases greatly determine the effectiveness of forwardly deployed fleets. Second, the security of such bases depends on the pulse of the land war, or at least on the status of ground forces in the surrounding territory that can transcend battle at sea. As war began in Europe in 1939, the British Navy never imagined that within a year the Kriegsmarine would soon control, either through outright occupation or alliance, nearly all of the coasts of continental Europe. By autumn 1941, the Wehrmacht had absorbed much of European Russia. In contrast, Britain remained as vulnerable by sea as it had been in World War I, but with some substantial disadvantages this time around. Germany quickly obtained the shorelines of Norway and France as windows on the Atlantic for its fleet. Britain, with the exception of Gibraltar, soon lost all its prior friendly ports on the European Atlantic coastline. Hitler now also had the Italian Mediterranean fleet as an ally. Britain lost the French Navy, the world's fourth largest, as a partner. Suddenly, cutting off Britain from its imports should have been far easier than in World War I, and far more practicable than the British efforts to stall the Wehrmacht by restricting maritime imports into Germany. A number of general turning points would determine whether the Germans could cut off Britain. First was the Axis-Allied race to create the larger navy. More specifically, the Germans sought to replace lost U-boats and crews faster than the British and Americans could build new merchant ships and convoy escort ships. The tonnage war also depended not just on relative economic strength, but also on the exposure of shipping yards, pens, and related factories to enemy air attacks, and the respective strategic choices over allotment of key resources. Second, each power sought to incorporate breakthroughs in ship design, communications, intelligence, armament, and detection more rapidly than did its adversary. The rather sudden emergence of credible German and Italian fleets by 1939 was not necessarily an accurate barometer of what would follow, given that the Allies had not been updating commensurately their own larger navies in the decade prior to the outbreak of the war. Germany and Japan eventually produced some highly innovative new nautical technologies, ranging from sophisticated torpedoes, nocturnal optics, the Type 21 U-boat and mines, to the snorkel and complex cryptology, but they rarely shared enough of their scientific advancements in submarines. They were ill-prepared to rush new breakthroughs into mass production, at least in the brilliant fashion of the British. And they lacked the capital and manpower of the Allies' counterintelligence and scientific agencies. Third, it was unclear whether air power more likely aided U-boats in sinking merchant ships or helped convoys to destroy U-boats. Comparative advantage would hinge both on the ability to make more and better long-range planes and the strategic choices of when and how to use such air power. Fourth, either the German or British Admiralty would benefit more from the cooperation of its allies. Although Italy dispatched a few submarines to the Atlantic, there was zero chance that the Italian and Japanese surface fleets would play any prominent role in the Atlantic. And while Germany occasionally sent a U-boat to the Indian Ocean or South Pacific, German submarines of the so-called Monsoon Group were of little help to Japan. In contrast, the Americans and British were full partners at sea in the European theater and rival partners in the Pacific. Fifth, the ongoing and constantly changing pulse of the war on land would better aid either the German or the British naval effort. Either British or German war obligations beyond the Atlantic would likely siphon off critical naval resources to a greater comparative degree. Most important, changes in strategic geography prompted by the entrance of the United States and the Soviet Union into the war would likely alter operations in the Atlantic. The Seesaw Battle of the Atlantic underwent several phases. All of them were predicated on sudden changes in the five defining moments just mentioned. The first months of the submarine war went well enough for the Allies, despite assorted disasters elsewhere on land and in the air. Britain had started the conflict with far more anti-submarine vessels, over 180 destroyers, than the Third Reich had U-boats. The weaker naval power was tasked with going on the offensive not just against the world's largest navy, but also against the enormous merchant marines of North America and the British Empire at large. Oddly, given all the lessons of U-boat lethality in World War I and talk of Nazi rearmament, Germany began the war with a comparatively insignificant fleet of submarines, many of which were smaller, obsolete Type II coastal boats. The Type IIs lacked the range, speed, size, armament, and communications of the newer Type 7 series, which themselves were never really fit for effective service across the vast Atlantic. In addition, well into 1941, the Germans were plagued by faulty magnetic torpedoes, a large percentage of which failed to explode on contact, nullifying the best efforts of U-boat captains, and thereby nearly ruining morale. From their experience in World War I, the British almost immediately began escorting convoys from North America. The Germans had not yet perfected the strategies of, or had the resources for, massed wolf packs deployed deep into the Atlantic, safe from air attack, that laid in wait for slow-moving convoys. For such a small U-boat fleet, the chances that individual submarines would find ships far out in the Atlantic were slim. Nonetheless, Britain immediately saw the need to increase its already large destroyer fleet by any means necessary. By September 1940, it had pressed the United States for the stopgap measure of an additional 50 World War I mothballed destroyers as part of swaps for bases in Newfoundland and the Caribbean. The deal is often ridiculed today as one-sided and ungenerous on the part of the United States. True, many of the destroyers of the Caldwell and Wicks classes may have been less than modern and in terrible shape, but the majority of them would see plenty of service against U-boats and survive the war. 19 of the ships were quite adequate Clemson-class destroyers, which the United States itself used throughout the conflict. Meanwhile, Germany was losing surface ships as Britain was now adding them. Hitler's two-month-long assault on Denmark and Norway, April 9 through June 10, 1940, ended up costing the Kriegsmarine three heavy and light cruisers and 10 destroyers, while siphoning off U-boats from the Battle of the Atlantic at precisely the time Britain increased its anti-submarine fleet. Britain also held the early technological edge due to much longer experience with early radar and sonar sets, or ASDIC, Anti-Submarine Detection Investigation Committee. Together, such systems could offer newfound advantages in locating subs on and beneath the surface. British grand strategies for dealing with U-boats, convoys, sonar detection, depth charges, and air surveillance and attack had primarily been tested since the last year of World War I and had been institutionalized in the fleet. Winston Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, had provided his full support for addressing the U-boat peril. In contrast, German naval strategy still remained confused. Admirals Dönitz and Raeder still vied for Hitler's attention to focus on either surface ships or U-boats. In addition, from September 1939 to June 1940, the French fleet had joined the British in patrolling the European Atlantic coasts. The German Navy, however, was still confined to its original North and Baltic seaports. For much of the winter there, harbors froze over and the distance from the Atlantic routes vastly limited U-boat ranges. By early 1940, the brief U-boat offensive had largely failed. For most of 1939, Dönitz was scarcely able to ensure that more than 10 U-boats were actually out in the Atlantic on patrol at any given time. He needed new bases, far more late-model U-boats, and a different way of using them if he were to avoid the verdict of the past war. In the second year of the war, the pulse of the tonnage battle radically changed. The numbers of Allied ships sunk by U-boats in the North Atlantic soared. From an average of about 28 merchant ships destroyed per month in the last 4 months of 1939, the tally grew to a monthly rate of about 40 ships throughout 1940. This was largely due to improved German U-boat production. Only 1.5 ships had been built per month in 1939. But output reached over 4 per month in 1940 and up to an incredible 16.5 in 1941. Just as important, newer Type 7C U-boats slowly entered service. They would eventually become the mainstay of the new U-boat fleet. 568 of them were to be commissioned during the war. The Type 7Cs were faster, had longer ranges, and were stocked with more torpedoes than all earlier German models. Nevertheless, their efficacy by global standards was often exaggerated. In comparison to American Gatto-class subs of 1941 and 1942 that were rapidly replaced and improved upon by the Balau and Tench classes, the nimble and easily maneuverable 7C was outclassed in a variety of categories. Far fewer torpedoes, far smaller, far less range, far more uncomfortable and slower. The superiority of American submarines and the relative inferiority of German U-boats is rarely noted, given their vastly different theaters of operation. Dönitz also soon perfected the strategy of wolf pack attacks, in which several U-boats lay in ambush for plotting convoys. Since the mid-1930s, the Germans also had broken some British naval codes and often had advance warning of the timing and routes of many convoys. Dönitz carefully charted his zones of attack so that they were all well out of range of first-generation British air patrols. Now, with months of aggregate experience, dozens of U-boat commanders had vastly improved and refined their operational tactics. The odds were slowly beginning to favor the Germans. Events on land also helped the Kriegsmarine. The fall of the Western European democracies in June 1940 completely redefined the U-boat war. New bomb-proof sub-pens on the French coast at the warm-water harbors of Bordeaux, Brest, La Rochelle, Lorient, and Saint-Nazaire gave refuge to the Atlantic-bound U-boats some 500 miles closer to the battle zone than their former North Sea bases. U-boats used that savings in distance to range farther out into the Atlantic. Lufthansa's premier pre-war airliner, the pathbreaking four-engine Focke Wulf FW-200 Condor with wartime adaptations, could stay aloft for 14 hours with occasional ranges over 2,000 miles. Once based on the French coast, small fleets of radar-equipped Condors scoured the mid-Atlantic, providing valuable intelligence to U-boat commanders. By war's end, the planes equipped with bomb racks and crude bomb sites had also accounted for the sinking of over 350,000 tons of Allied shipping. Yet inexplicably, fewer than 300 Condors were to be built, about a tenth of the number of the somewhat smaller two-engine American Consolidated Catalina PBY flying boats, too few to change the tempo of the Atlantic War. The perfect storm of 1940 only grew worse for the British. What was left of the French fleet after July 1940 now was rendered largely irrelevant. A month later, an opportunistic Mussolini would send 26 of his own submarines to Bordeaux to aid German U-boats in the Atlantic. The British suddenly found themselves at war in Norwegian waters and in the Mediterranean at a time when they were forced to send more supply convoys to their distant Pacific colonies in increasing fear of Japan. Meanwhile, fear of German invasion for most of 1940 argued for the Royal Navy to remain closer to home. These added responsibilities conspired to disperse and weaken British anti-submarine strength throughout the North Atlantic. The net result was increasing German confidence that the U-boats might succeed where the Luftwaffe had not in forcing their sole remaining enemy, Great Britain, to accept a negotiated armistice. Yet by spring 1941, against all odds and mostly alone, the British slowly began to check German submarine advances. For the third time in 2 years, the momentum of the seesaw Battle of the Atlantic once again began to reverse. Despite more experienced captains, improved torpedoes, and more submarines, Germany was again on the defensive as U-boats were rendered little more effective than in 1939. The geostrategic responsibilities of the two adversaries had once again flipped. Germany was now forced to deploy ever more of its manpower from the Arctic Circle to the Sahara without yet fully exploiting Europe's aggregate industrial potential. For the first 6 months of 1941, the Wehrmacht focused on planning Operation Barbarossa as critical resources were directed to the Army and Luftwaffe in an anticipated land and air war well over 1,000 miles distant from the North Atlantic. In contrast, by spring 1941, Great Britain no longer had any Western European exposure. In the months before the Japanese attack on Singapore, its responsibilities had shrunk largely to a one-front war in North Africa, the failed defense of Greece, and a still anemic air campaign over the continent. As was true during even the worst months of the Blitz, when a supposedly beleaguered Britain outproduced Germany's aircraft industry, the British and Canadians built more merchant ships, destroyers, and corvettes than the Third Reich could produce U-boats per month, even at the Kriegsmarine's new accelerated rate. With the sinking of the German flagship Bismarck in May 1941, the prior 20-month effort of the Third Reich's surface fleet to harass the Royal Navy and weaken the British merchant marine for all practical purposes came to an end. Many of Admiral Rader's once promising new cruisers and battleships were at the bottom of the Atlantic, damaged, hiding, or bottled up by British ships in French, German, or Norwegian ports. The responsibility of containing what was left of the German surface navy was largely outsourced to British fighter and bomber forces, freeing up yet more Royal Navy ships to focus on U-boats. Equally important, improved British radar sets were not yet matched by German countermeasures. Their effectiveness was further enhanced after May 1941, when the British Navy salvaged from 2 U-boats, one captured, one sunk, cryptographic tables and elements of the Enigma cipher machine itself. For the last 6 months of 1941, British codebreakers were able to read German naval communications routed through the Enigma cipher, an effort enhanced by Admiral Dönitz's micromanagement of his fleet that required a vast corpus of daily coded radio transmissions. The British Admiralty could either route North American convoys well around Wolfpack rendezvous points, or intercept and destroy lone U-boats heading to and from their engagement areas. Again, the key to British cryptological superiority in the U-boat war was not just technological or predicated on chance capture of German codes and coding machines, but rather on a much more sophisticated and comprehensive approach to deciphering and disseminating such knowledge to the armed forces in a rapid and pragmatic fashion. Germany was not quite done yet. By early 1942, the Axis and Allies had opened yet a fourth, and the most lethal, chapter to the Battle of the Atlantic, once again hinging on vastly changed strategies, geography, technology, and productive capacity. In February 1942, German naval intelligence introduced a so-called fourth wheel and greater complexity to the Enigma cipher machines that all but ended the ability of the Allies to listen in on U-boat communications for several months. At about the same time, the German Naval Surveillance Service, B-Dienst, also made greater inroads in cracking the so-called British and Allied Merchant Ships Code, BAMS. For a critical few months of 1942, most communications about planned Allied convoy operations and routes were known in advance to the Kriegsmarine, suggesting that U-boat commanders now knew far more about the plans of their intended targets than their British targets knew about them. The entry of the United States into the war in December 1941 should have offered immediate and unequivocal advantages for the British. The pre-war U.S. fleet was still the second largest in the world and now could operate freely against U-boats. Unfortunately, for the first 6 months of the American war, the very opposite proved true. Germany enjoyed newfound advantages precisely because America's mostly unprotected merchant fleet at last became fair game. For a variety of reasons, Admiral Ernest King, Chief of Naval Operations, did not immediately deploy American warships to escort Britain-bound convoys. In the initial months of outrage over Pearl Harbor, King resisted diverting too many U.S. ships from the war against Japan. And in truth, for all his anti-British posturing, King did not yet have many American destroyers and long-range bombers on hand to focus on the U-boats. The result was that U-boats could feast on American merchant ships as they first set out from their East Coast ports. Slow-moving transports were often easily silhouetted against brightly lit cities that were not subject to blackouts. Month after month, cargoes of food, gas, and war material were blown up, often with most of their crews in sight of the American coast. In the first 8 months of the new U-boat war against America, the Germans in Operation Paukenschlag, Drumbeat, sank over 600 ships, totaling over 3 million tons of shipping, at a loss of little more than 20 U-boats. Such lopsided totals should have broken the back of any incoming belligerent without sizable reserves of merchant ships. Dönitz was able to deploy scarcely more than a dozen submarines off the American East Coast, a fact that makes the U-boat achievement even more astonishing. By marginally custom-fitting Type 7s for extended ranges and deploying a handful of the larger new Type 9 U-boats, the Battle of the Atlantic now sought to expand permanently into American waters. Over 200 of the Type 9 U-boats would eventually be built. If they were less agile and submerged far more slowly than earlier models, they also had a greater range of operation as well as 6 torpedo tubes, rather than the 5 of most Type 7 models, and more powerful engines. As autumn 1942 approached, Dönitz believed that at last he was harvesting Allied ships faster than they were being built, the most important calculus of the Battle of the Atlantic, while Britain's factories and armies were running out of vital resources. He assumed likewise that the Japanese fleet, unbeaten in a string of victories from December 1941 to May 1942, was drawing off American surface ships to the Pacific. The need to supply the Soviet Union likewise meant that additional American merchant ships were diverted from the North Atlantic route. The result was that as the Allies spread their strength, a refocused German U-boat fleet found advantage against North American convoys. Yet the blinker Dönitz did not grasp that his startling success after the entry of the United States into the war was a temporary aberration that was due less to German prowess than to American inexperience and poor choices. Once Admiral King released convoy escorts and new long-range B-24 Liberators began air escorts, though never in enough numbers, the U-boats would find 1943 as terrible a year as much of 1942 had proved uplifting. The greatest obstacle to the success of the U-boats was the unprecedented U.S. production of destroyers, corvettes, and more merchant ships. By the last 3 months of 1942, less money was spent on building battleships, carriers, and cruisers, as well as armored vehicles, due to the urgent need to win the war against U-boats. American strategists saw that if their supply ships could not reach Great Britain and keep the sea lanes open for troop transport, then the size of the American Expeditionary Army targeted to land on the shores of Mediterranean and Western Europe would not much matter. The brief German resurgence had also been based on a transitory intelligence advantage. But in October 1942, the British once again cracked the modified German naval code after the salvaging of Enigma key sheets and settings from another wrecked U-boat, and by December were once again reading Admiral Dönitz's communications. The British also appointed a new anti-submarine commander, Admiral Sir Max Kennedy Horton, who continued the key innovations of his predecessor, Admiral Percy Noble. The two together had fashioned novel tactics, among them more independent killer anti-submarine ships that were able to range more widely to focus on convoys under attack by U-boats, as well as providing support vessels to help save crews. The Hunters then soon permanently became the Hunted. As was true of General James Doolittle's command decision of February 1944 to release American fighters from their direct bomber escort duties so that they might range freely in search of German airfields and distant Luftwaffe fighters, so too British surface ships increasingly proactively took the war to the U-boats. Whether in the air or on the seas, the rationale was similar. Individual pilots and captains, when freed from direct proximity to bombers and merchant ships, could find all sorts of multidimensional ways to hunt down their adversaries where and when they were most vulnerable. The best defense proved to be an audacious offense freed from present doctrine. While Germans worked on long-term technological breakthroughs like snorkels and hydrogen-powered propulsion, the Allies implemented more incremental and practical advances, multiple firing depth charge throwers, powerful new airborne searchlights, small escort carriers that could bring their own air cover along with a convoy, and always improved radar and sonar. By mid-1943, these changes had at last all but doomed the entire U-boat effort. Convoy ONS-5 that crossed the Atlantic in April and May 1943 is often viewed as emblematic of the final Allied victory in the Atlantic. The ensemble steamed across the Atlantic with one accompanying warship for every three merchant vessels. Despite being attacked by wolf packs of nearly 40 U-boats for over a week, at least 30 to 42 Allied merchant ships got through. Six of the attacking U-boats, however, were lost and more were damaged. In later weeks, Atlantic convoys suffered minimal losses, or at least far fewer than did the U-boat packs that attacked them. The Battle of the Atlantic had all but ended by autumn 1943. In May alone, the Germans had lost a quarter of all their deployed U-boat fleet, 43 in 1 month, while sinking only 58 ships, a mere fraction of the Allied monthly new production. Meanwhile, American shipyards were turning out hundreds of Liberty and larger Victory merchant ships, totaling well over 3,200 by the end of the war. Although U-boats remained an irritant throughout the war, they posed no serious threat in the conflict's final 24 months. Admiral Dönitz confessed that by early 1943, radar, and particularly radar location by aircraft, had to all practical purposes robbed the U-boats of their power to fight on the surface. I accordingly withdrew the boats from the North Atlantic. We had lost the Battle of the Atlantic. Despite monthly increases in Allied convoys, the transatlantic route for the vast majority of merchant ships in 1944 and 1945 from North America to Britain was nearly risk-free. Although he had destroyed an enormous amount of Allied shipping at sea, Dönitz never curtailed Allied convoys, nor, of course, could he extinguish factory production at the source, the most economical method of destroying the means to conduct a war. Consequently, the Allied merchant fleet was larger after the Battle of the Atlantic than before. The best that could be said for the German U-boat campaign was that it was the only theater of the war where Germany may have won in the narrow terms of a relative cost-to-benefit analysis of men and material, even as it lost the War of the Atlantic. Naval supremacy in the Eastern Mediterranean determined critical entrance to and exit from the Suez Canal, the proclivities of a neutral but always opportunistic Turkey, and the fate of key British supply bases in Egypt. Yet after the bold German capture of Crete in April 1941, the Eastern Mediterranean remained largely static. Germans and Italians went on to occupy the Dodecanese islands that remained Axis-controlled until the end of the war, and from there used their air power to control much of the Aegean. Yet Germany and Italy were never able to exploit that propitious beginning to alter the course of the Mediterranean theater, much less permanently alter transit via Suez from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The Axis failure again was attributable to the vast superiority of the Royal Navy, which, protected by RAF squadrons, continued to operate freely out of Alexandria and Cyprus. Neither base was ever systematically bombed by the Germans or Italians. And after the December 1941 attack by Italian frogmen on two British battleships in Alexandria and the German failure at El Alamein, British bases in the eastern Mediterranean were all but secure for the rest of the war. Far from using Crete and the Dodecanese Islands as starting points for further conquests that might result in strategic advantage, Germany's earlier eastern Mediterranean acquisitions died on the vine, becoming irrelevant by the end of 1943. Fantasists in Japan and Germany had earlier dropped their illusions of ever meeting at Suez. Yet Churchill's grand plans in autumn 1943 of retaking the Greek Aegean and Dodecanese Islands also proved a failure on all counts. The Germans enjoyed air superiority from Aegean island air bases. America was not interested in the Dodecanese campaign, and it was hard to see how replacing Germans with British in the Aegean would much aid the Allied cause that was soon to be determined in Western and Eastern Europe. In sum, the Mediterranean east of Greece, despite occasional bitter fighting to the end of the war, became a backwater without much change after summer 1941. It was a veritable Mediterranean Norway, another occupation that had idled needed German troops since 1940, that cost the Third Reich capital and manpower without offering much strategic recompense. The Central and Western Mediterranean were quite a different story. Unlike British-held Egypt, North Africa, from eastern Libya to the Atlantic, was soon the scene of constant battle, especially as southern France and Italy became the focus of Allied amphibious landings. Malta and Sicily, closer to Germany's borders and the ultimate nexus of the war, were as violently fought over in 1942 and 1943 as Cyprus and Crete remained quiet. Despite initial British victories in a series of encounters with the Italian surface navy from 1940 to mid-1942, the Axis still enjoyed the advantage. The French fleet was either sunk or retired by June 1940. The United States had little presence in the Mediterranean until late 1942. British airfields at Gibraltar, Malta, and Alexandria were offset by Axis fighter bases in Crete, Libya, and Sicily. There were still more Italian surface ships and German U-boats in the Mediterranean than there were British vessels. Against such odds, somehow Britain maintained a Mediterranean passage to its beleaguered troops in Malta and Egypt. The reason was again superior British operational skill. In a series of showdowns with the British Mediterranean Navy, the larger Italian fleet, lacking good radar, secure fuel supplies, and familiarity with night fighting, was often port-bound or limited to brief breakouts. Like the Imperial Japanese Navy's initial parity with the American Pacific Fleet, numbers proved deceiving. Whereas Britain could transfer warships from the Atlantic and Pacific and build more ships, Italy's resources were ossified, and its shipbuilding industry was static. Britain risked battleships and cruisers, and most survived. Italy hoarded and lost them. In the first major battle at the Italian base at Taranto, November 11th and 12th, 1940, carrier-based British aircraft, under their audacious admiral Andrew Cunningham, torpedoed the Italian fleet in its home port, seriously damaging three battleships, two disabled, one sunk. The battle was the first in history in which carrier-based planes without help from surface ships had sunk battleships, and its effect on Mussolini was dramatic. The Italian fleet was soon transferred northward from its opportune but now exposed Mediterranean perch. Although the fleet often ventured out to challenge Malta-bound convoys, and two of the damaged battleships were back in service in less than a year, the Regia Marina would never take on the British fleet with any degree of confidence. Ironies followed from the landmark battle. The Japanese supposedly studied the attack closely in planning for Pearl Harbor, especially the innovative ability of British planes to use their torpedoes in a shallow water port. Perhaps this close emulation was also why they, like the British, did not later follow up initially successful strikes with further attacks that could have destroyed the American fleet and its facilities entirely. Meanwhile, even the British had apparently learned little from their own revolutionary success. A little over a year later, the battleship Prince of Wales and the old but still powerful battlecruiser Repulse would be sent to Singapore without fighter escort and would easily be blown apart by Japanese land-based planes in even more dramatic fashion than the manner in which British carrier pilots had earlier trounced Italian battleships. Admiral Cunningham struck again at Cape Matapan, March 27 through 29, 1941, off the Greek Peloponnese a little over 4 months later. His Commonwealth fleet sank 3 Italian cruisers and 2 destroyers, all without radar capability, without suffering serious losses. Again, better British seamanship, audacity, radar, and intelligence explained the lopsided result. The only way for the Axis powers to destroy the British Mediterranean fleet was through air power and U-boats, and not through the numerical superiority of their Italian cruisers and battleships. For example, in fights off Crete in May 1941, the Luftwaffe sank 2 British light cruisers and 6 destroyers with minimal losses. In the constant struggle to isolate Malta and disrupt British supplies to North Africa, Axis air power, along with U-boats and mines, seemed close to winning the Battle of the Mediterranean by the end of 1942, sinking 2 British carriers, a battleship, over 10 cruisers, and more than 40 destroyers, along with 40 submarines. To aid the U-boats, the Italian fleet was supposed to whittle down British destroyers that could be used for anti-submarine operations. Yet once again, the Italian Navy would not take risks. The British, even with far greater resources deployed elsewhere, did. The British Mediterranean fleet grew larger than the Italian throughout 1942 and 1943, even as it lost more ships. Until the late arrival of the Americans on November 8, 1942, the British had envisioned 3 aims in winning the Mediterranean naval war: ensuring that reliable supply routes to their troops in North Africa could soon be maintained, diminishing Axis sea power enough to ensure amphibious landings in North Africa and southern Europe, and re-establishing a much safer route from Britain through the Suez Canal to the Indian and Pacific Oceans. In achieving these agendas, Admiral Cunningham proved to be not just a better sea lord than his German and Italian counterparts, but perhaps the premier admiral of the entire European theater. In contrast, it would be hard to come up with a worse Axis maritime strategy in the Mediterranean than what Hitler and Mussolini had crafted. Malta, not Crete, was the strategic linchpin between the continents, and yet it was never seriously assaulted by land. Again, the Dodecanese Islands were a strategic dead end. Seizing Gibraltar should have been the overriding concern of Hitler. Yet he failed in negotiations with Spain's Francisco Franco, who, after the cataclysm of the Spanish Civil War, wanted to stay out of Hitler's war, or, barring that, wanted much of Vichy France's North African territory. Hitler's failure to win over Spain created the anomaly of British Gibraltar controlling the western entry into and exit from the Mediterranean, despite being surrounded on all shores by hostile neutrals or Axis enemies. It was perhaps ironic that had Germany not supplied Franco during the Spanish Civil War, and had the Republicans won, Hitler in autumn 1940 likely could have simply invaded and exhausted Spain shortly after the fall of France, and might well have taken Gibraltar. The Pacific War in 1942 drew off British naval assets to Burma and for the protection of India, but not to the same degree that Operation Barbarossa shorted the Axis Mediterranean, an area that Hitler himself once scoffed that the Germans had no interest in. As was true almost everywhere else in the war, the disastrous decision to invade the Soviet Union ensured that the Axis could never marshal the wherewithal to drive the British out of the Mediterranean for good. After late 1942, the Italian fleet was almost out of both oil and ships. It could play no real role in salvaging the North African Axis expeditionary forces. German U-boats on occasion would sink Allied ships even in the very last days of the war, but the era of wolf pack attacks crippling Mediterranean commerce were long over. The British and American fleets by mid-1943 could land on Mediterranean shores any time and anywhere they chose. Of the some 60 U-boats that at one time or another entered the Mediterranean, only one survived the war. Mussolini's pipe dream of an ever-growing, whoever stops is lost, North African empire and refashioned Mare Nostrum vanished. So did Erwin Rommel's brief hope of heading to Suez and perhaps even meeting up with Army Group South, the southern prong of Hitler's three armies that had invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941, to drive through the Middle East to the Caspian Sea. The key to success in the Mediterranean was never how much area a power controlled. A map of Italian versus British territory in 1942 proved lopsided in favor of the former, but the location of the territory. As long as Gibraltar, Suez, and Malta, the entry, exit, and midway valves of the Mediterranean, remained British, they proved far more important Mediterranean bases than did Rhodes, Crete, and Sicily. Given growing Allied fleet and air power, the only Axis hope in the Mediterranean was a swift German victory over the Soviet Union. The addition of allies such as neutral Turkey and Spain, greater availability of ships and planes, and Japanese naval approaches to the Suez Canal. All were still possible in late 1941, unlikely by autumn 1942, and impossible by early 1943. Still, the Mediterranean never quite panned out for the Allies, at least as Churchill originally envisioned, as the entry point into Austria and Germany through the soft underbelly of Europe. At best, Allied naval superiority in the Mediterranean meant that Sicily, Italy, and southern France were all to be invaded, with a stationing of long-range Allied bombers in Italy for deeper penetration into eastern Germany and its eastern European partners. In addition, once the Kriegsmarine and the Regia Marina ceased to exist as viable navies, Britain could ensure relatively easy transport of supplies and troops through the Mediterranean to the Pacific. The anomaly about naval war in the European theater was that it largely ended 2 years before the collapse of Germany and Italy. Despite occasional losses to vestigial U-boats, after late 1943, Allied ships were largely free to go where they wished and do what they wanted, in a way not so true of land operations until late 1944 or early 1945. The Pacific Naval War should have progressed with far more difficulty for the British and the Americans, given the greater resources of the Japanese Imperial Fleet and the ostensible Allied Europe First policy of allotting resources. Instead, the British and American fleets achieved parity in 6 months, naval superiority in 2 years, and outright supremacy in less than three. By 1944, Allied naval power was free to turn nearly all its attention to ensuring supply and enhancing ground and air power, the chief objectives of putting a fleet to sea. 9. A vast ocean. The South Pacific was part of a far larger ocean, considerably more distant from the centers of Allied naval command in Washington and London than either the Mediterranean or the Atlantic. To a far greater degree, naval operations hinged on air power, amphibious landings, the acquisition of island bases, and the availability of fuel depots, all of which ensured that supply ships, troop transports, tankers, and convoys took on enormous importance. The three largest fleets in the world, the British, American, and Japanese, collided in the Pacific, and it was no accident that the largest sea battles of the war, Pearl Harbor, the Coral Sea, Midway, off Guadalcanal, the Philippine Sea, and Leyte Gulf were all Pacific engagements. In late February 1942, just 2 months after Pearl Harbor, a patched-together Allied fleet of American, British, Dutch, and Australian cruisers and destroyers, the so-called ABDA Command, collided with a Japanese force of about the same size in the Java Sea. The Allied ships had come to sink Japanese convoys and thereby stop the invasion of Java, and therefore the Japanese momentum. But when the main battle and its follow-up skirmishes were finally over, the largest surface ship encounters since the Battle of Jutland, two Allied cruisers and three destroyers were sunk. Over 2,300 seamen were killed, including the commander of the fleet, the audacious Dutch Admiral Karl Doorman, who went down with his flagship, the De Ruyter. The Allies failed to sink a single Japanese warship. Only 36 Japanese sailors were lost. The slaughter at the Battle of the Java Sea dispelled any of the Allies' ethnocentric doubts about Japanese control of the Pacific after Pearl Harbor. Indeed, the Allies now thought Japanese sailors were supermen and feared that their own initial defeats near Singapore and at Pearl Harbor may have been unavoidable rather than aberrant. When the war began, in almost every area of naval operations, the Japanese seemed to hold the advantages in the Pacific. Their cruisers and destroyers were generally larger and better armed than their Allied counterparts. Japanese naval gunfire was more accurate, especially at night. Allied ships were not as well led, coordinated, or organized. One would have thought that Japan, not Britain, enjoyed a 500-year naval tradition of global supremacy and had invented dreadnoughts, large-caliber naval guns, and steam propulsion. By the end of 1942, 6 months after the American victory at Midway, four of the six Pacific-based U.S. carriers, Hornet, Lexington, Yorktown, and Wasp, were sunk, and a fifth, Saratoga, was damaged and out of action. The naval war in the Pacific never followed patterns of sea fighting in the Atlantic and Mediterranean. For one, the matchup between the combatants was far different. Both sides had carrier fleets. The war started in earnest not in autumn 1939, but over 2 years later, when aviation and carrier technologies were already adapting to wartime conditions and vastly improving, and the larger lessons from the Atlantic and Mediterranean could be digested. The British and Americans, for the most part, fought only one naval enemy, the Japanese, not two, as in Europe. After 1943, the Axis European powers offered little indirect aid in drawing off Allied ships from the Pacific. Except for some initial and final joint operations, the British and Americans found no immediate need to coordinate ship-to-ship or amphibious operations against Japan, as had been true in the Mediterranean and Atlantic. In British eyes, Singapore's fall was psychologically catastrophic, but perhaps insignificant in comparison to the incendiary burning of London. In contrast, the only American territory directly and seriously attacked in the war was by Japan, not Germany. Great Britain had no Pacific coastline. America's was over 1,200 miles in length. These paradoxes also helped to explain why the American Navy would take the lead in